Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. And today we have, I think, an outstanding opportunity to hear more about our watershed research cooperative that's been going on, and I look forward to that. So from our forestry department, we have a few distinguished guests, so they can introduce themselves.
Distinguished. Chair Roblin, member of the committee. And committee administrator. I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. The Watershed Research Cooperative really is kind of a unique effort. It really became a field of dreams approach a number of years back when, after what we called the Forest Practice Advisory Committee process in the late 1990s completed, there was a lot of issues about what information was lacking in terms of the connectivity between water quality, fish habitat, elements around temperature and how that's influenced by forest practices in particular, and also then how do you tie that into ensuring that you have economically efficient forest practices so we can assure that landowners can maintain their needs as well as meet the needs of fish and water quality. Based upon a fairly simple idea of trying to connect the physical with the biological and the notion of using paired watershed studies to do that, we put together a cooperative. Initially started off with Hinkle Creek, which is one of three now studies underway. Has a tremendous number of partners, with OSU taking the lead, and I have with me today Dr. Arne Skogset from the OSU College of Forestry, who's the director of the Watershed Research Cooperative. In addition to OSU, which includes both the College of Agriculture and College of Forestry, our number of other partners, including the U.S. Geological Survey, Department of Forestry, Department of Fish and Wildlife, number of timber operators, both large and small. We also have a number of other partners that have collaborated with us on this, which includes the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that actually helps support the infrastructure of the Hinkle Creek study. And then a number of other partners we'll be talking about later if you'd like to learn more about that. And with that, I'll let Dr. Skogset start about the cooperative. We'll answer your questions when we're done, or you feel free to interrupt us as you prefer.
Thank you, Ted. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today. My name is Arne Skogset. I'm an associate professor of forest hydrology in the Forest Engineering Department with the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. I also, right now, fill the position of the director of the Watersheds Research Cooperative. And in addition to that, I have PI, principal investigator responsibilities for two of the paired watershed studies. So I'm pretty well into these pretty deep. This is the Watersheds Research Cooperative. Basically, if we look at the background and we just go back to 99-2000 and talk about kind of why the cooperative, if you followed the history at all of where we are with forestry in Oregon, increasingly a larger and larger proportion of the annual cut in the state of forestry, the annual harvest, is coming off of private land, and not only private land, but private industrial land. It's not quite 80-20 in the 80-20 rule, but it's something like seven over the last 5 years, 70-75% of the annual harvest is coming off of the 22% of the commercial forest land in the state of Oregon, which is private industrial forest land. And since the 1990s, since we've seen a large bifurcation in where the source of the annual harvest is coming from, increasingly the harvest is coming off of forests on private industrial land in which the trees were planted and cultured by that landowner. So the concept of natural forests, or the concepts of some natural young second growth, I mean, increasingly the landowners have got to plant and culture the trees they're going to harvest, and this requires intensive forest management. And as you're aware, there's a lot of concerns about intensive forest management and environmental effects. So that's kind of where we came from. It was always considered to be a win-win investment in science. So in kind of in 99-2000, some of the representatives from the Forest Practice Advisory Committee, folks that had been on that committee, came to OSU and came to us sort of asking the question, what can we be done? Because through the process, of the Governor's Salmon Plan, going through the Memorandum of Understanding Committee, and then going into the Forest Practice Advisory Committee, one of the things those committees were very good at doing is pointing out where the gaps in the science were. And if you talk to members of those committees, which I did in 1999-2000 when this came up, they admitted that in the process of having gaps in knowledge, they had no recourse except to be a little bit more conservative in the rulemaking language as a result of having those gaps. And so we talked to a number of landowners, and pretty much what they said to us was, we know if we don't try to get some data to fill those gaps in 5 years or in 10 years, we're going to be revisiting these same issues. And the response is going to be the same as far as what we need to do with respect to being conservative or not. So we really need to collect some data. We really need to find a way to get some data to put in the holds. If you look at the Forest Practice Advisory Committee recommendations, what you'll find out that there's two places where there's glaring gaps in the science, and we kind of have moved to kind of put plugs in those. One is what we're going to call headwater streams. In Oregon, it's pretty easy. It's non-fish-bearing streams. So you go to the point where there are no longer fish in those streams, and you look upstream, and those are the headwater or non-fish-bearing streams. They're the most numerous streams out there. There's more total length of them than any other stream. They are the most tightly connected to the terrestrial environment. They've got a real tight connection because they're very, very small. And the understanding and data on just what those streams are and how they react to management is probably the least understood. Most of the research up until this point has been on mainstem fish-bearing streams. We spent a lot of time worrying about if we harvest adjacent to perennial mainstream fish-bearing streams, what's that impact going to be? The next thing, and probably the other real big gap in the science is, if you go back to the Governor's Salmon Plan, the emphasis with the Endangered Species Act was on fish down in mainstem fish-bearing stems. At the same time, we're really interested in practices adjacent to these non-fish-bearing streams, so we really have to find a way to link those two. We have to find a vector. We have to find a way that the practices on the non-fish-bearing streams, how they're going to affect mainstem fish-bearing streams, and really that's the cumulative impacts issue. And when we get into that, we get into watershed-scale research. So those two things, as far as science, those are what's driving the science of these paired watershed studies that are a part of a co-op. Finally, and lastly, and it's not the science that's driving them, but it's very, very important for us to get some contemporary data sets. If you look back on the data, and if you look back on the references that FPAC used, the Forest Practices Advisory Committee kind of used, and you look at where that data came from, it for the most part is old paired watershed studies that were put in place in the 60s. So let me just give you a real good example of what I mean by getting contemporary data points. This is out of a 1995 NOAA fisheries book, and in it talks about the effect of forestry on stream temperature, and this figure is from it, figure 5.2, and in it says this is the typical daily stream temperature in a clear-cut forested streams during clear weather, Oregon's Coast Range. Quotes Besta et al., 1987. Well, if you go back to Besta et al. And you look at where the data comes from, it came from the original Alsea watershed study, and this was Needle Branch, the treated watershed, in the original Alsea paired watershed study. And what you're seeing there is a daily maximum, a daily temperature profile for the hottest day of the year for each of those those years, and you start with down in the shaded areas, the control in the green, that's unlogged, and then it runs through 1967 was the first year after 100% clear cut, and then you slowly see a recovery of the maximum stream temperature over time. But what I need to tell you, in 1966, when this is harvested, this is what the watershed looked like. So an absence, I mean, it was before any forest practice rules. There was an absence of riparian buffers. It was broadcast burn. And so this is the data that NOAA document is saying is a typical response. And so we've spent 35 years updating the forest practice rules. And the effect of those changes in the forest practice rules are not evident in that NOAA document when they talk about what they think the typical response is. And so that just leads us to say, okay, when we talk about a contemporary data set, when we talk about what's going on right now, what are the key things we kind of worry about, we're looking at, for the most part, 95% plus or even more. When we go into these stands, we're looking at a harvest-regenerated stand. We're looking at a stand with an existing road system. We don't have to build the roads. The roads are there to a large degree. State-of-the-art equipment, which has a very small environmental footprint, and the forest practice rules, so the contemporary forest practice rules. And that's kind of, we need a data point from something that represents those things, because when we look at our historic data points, we don't have that. So what the Watersheds Research Cooperative gives us is a chance to have this contemporary data point. For what it's worth, the photo in the background there is Hinkle Creek, and the prominent harvest units in the front are the first entry from the Hinkle Creek Paired Watershed Study. So as Ted said, the Watersheds Research Cooperative has three of these paired watershed studies on the books right now, attempting to look at the headwaters research, main stem, cumulative effects, fisheries response, and the contemporary data set issues. Hinkle Creek, which is down in southwest Oregon, is sort of the proof of concept installation that started in 2001. ALSI is a unique opportunity to look at a paired watershed study, which was part of probably the ALSI watershed study, had more influence on the current forest practice rules in Oregon than any other study. That was logged in 66. We'll talk about this in a little bit. It's ready to go online again. Have a tremendous opportunity to look at the effects of contemporary practices laid over the top of the existing study. And then the last one is the Trask, which is up in the Trask River, East Fork of the Trask in northwest Oregon. All the studies have some things in common. Of course, they all have their own context, so if we just briefly blitz through kind of the things. Hinkle Creek, southwest Oregon, 5,000 acres. We've got a control and a treated watershed, so the watershed scale in question there we're looking at is about 2,500 acres. It's basalt. It's a nested paired watershed study, meaning we can look at these small watershed scale. You know, if you look real closely, you can see the red outlined watershed and the green outlined watersheds are the small headwater watersheds that one level of treatment is going to take place on. And then, of course, we have the larger scale, or the 2,500-acre scale. This is private industrial land, Roseburg Forest Products. They've allowed us to do this on their ownership. And primarily the reason why we're on Roseburg Forest Products is they invited us to come there. Finding 5,000 acres as a study watershed is really, really hard. So they've allowed us to do it. We will have one treatment. That treatment will be the Oregon Forest Practice Rules, as we know them right now. Two entries. We have one entry which has taken place, which is in the headwater scale. Next summer will be the second entry, and that second entry will all be down on fish-bearing main stems. It allows us to look at cumulative effects in space, so it allows us to put an experimental design on at that level. Right now in Hinkle Creek, we're through the first entry, so those green units have been harvested. The red ones will be next summer. I went the wrong way. ALSI paired watershed study. Again, this is the original ALSI watershed study. The watershed you see up there, it is on the coast of Oregon. It's inland from Newport. We had a partial cut and a control and a 100% clear cut watershed in 66. Just to give you some idea of the scales, Flynn Creek, the control watershed, is about 500 acres. Needle Branch, the treated watershed, is about 180. It is Needle Branch that is going to be part of the study. The Forest Service owns Flynn Creek and owns Deer Creek. Flynn Creek is a natural resource area, so it makes a really good control. Deer Creek will not be part of the new study. So Plum Creek is the landowner we're working with at this time. It's classic Coast Range sandstone, so it's Thai sandstone. Again, we'll have a nested paired watershed study here, and that we're going to go into Needle Branch in two levels. The upper part of the watershed will be the first watershed that will be harvested, simply because the 180-acre size is too large for a single clear-cut operation under the current forest practice rules. So the top will go first, and then about 3 years later, the lower portions of the forest watershed will be harvested. So it is, again, a nested paired watershed study. There's only going to be one treatment, and that will be the Oregon Forest Practice Rules. There will be two entry. ALSI is in the calibration phase, so they have about 1 year data at this point. The last one is the Trask. It's a very ambitious study. It's in the East Fork of the Trask River, about 6,000 acres. It's pretty much evenly split between Oregon Department of Forestry state lands and Weyerhaeuser. So if you look at the top end of the watershed, the right-hand side, that is Weyerhaeuser ownership. Bottom half of that watershed ends up in Oregon state lands. Again, it's nested. You'll see some purple dots there. Those purple dots are the larger scale. Those are the larger scale cumulative effect sites where we're going to look at what the downstream impacts of those headwater units are. And then the smaller watersheds up top are the smaller scale, the headwater scale. So we're back to looking at what the effects of headwater management are. One entry, they'll go in, harvest only the small watersheds here. There will be nothing on the main stems. Mixed geology, again nested. And they're really not even up to calibration yet. There's been some preliminary data collected in here, but we've still yet to get the entire calibration data infrastructure in the Trask. So those are the three paired watershed studies we're looking at this point. They've got some common themes. They're different in what they look at. And the Trask is the only one in which we think we may be able to look at something other than just a standard Oregon Forest Practice Rules on state lands. The state lands half of this is the anchor salmon habitat for the state lands, and they're looking at doing something a little bit different. We're still 3 to 4 years out from seeing what goes on the ground, but that's the plan at this point. Let me run through some preliminary results and let you kind of see where we're going to, and just let you see that results are forthcoming. This was the first entry in Hinkle Creek. This is really the only entry where we have some post-treatment data to talk about. And what happened in there is those green units were put in during the winter of 05-06. Simply to give you some names, we'll be talking about these names, but as we go left to right, kind of smaller watersheds to larger watersheds, it was Fenton Creek, Clay Creek, Russell Creek, and Beebe Creek. So if you keep those in mind, Those names are put out there simply so you can kind of put those with some results as they come up. Again, it took place August to April, 05 to 06. This is important in that in the process of putting this on the ground, about 2 miles of new roads were constructed. About 3.5 miles of old road were reconstructed. This is simply important to let you know that that road systems there were basically rebuilding roads, not building new roads. It was all done during the winter. 17,000 cubic yards of rock, 12 million feet of timber. That's about 3,000 loads of logs. That's just to give you some context on the magnitude of how big the operation was. If we talk a little bit about what we think environmental impact is, on the first column, we can talk in these headwater watersheds, so these watersheds above the flumes, we can talk about what percent of the area was harvested, so it ranges from about 70% harvested down to about 13, so there's a gradient there. The second column is the percent of the total stream length that had harvesting adjacent to it. So that ran from 70% down to about a third. So again, that's just to put some context on those logging units. It's maybe more detail than you want, but again, to put some context on what was done there. All the trees were felled by hand. They were all logged tree length. They were, for the most part, logged tree length using Skyline harvest units, Skyline yarding systems. All the processing was done on the landing, so they came up tree length and either a stroke broom delimmer like that unit in the foreground on the left or a single grip dangle head processor that were used. But they were all processed by machine. Here is temperature results at the base of the clear cuts from the four harvest units. Four units again: Fenton, Clay, Russell, BB Creek. The black line is the calibration line. The blue data points are the data points from the calibration time period, and then the dotted lines are a prediction interval, which we can worry about or not. The gold points are the first summer post-treatment, post-logging data points. Interesting results. If you look at Fenton Creek, at least for the hotter days, we saw an absolute distinct decrease in stream temp. If you look at BB Creek, which is lower right, again, for the hotter days, without a doubt, an increase in maximum stream temperature. The other two, we can argue if we think we saw an impact or not. But again, four treatments, same streams, same timber, same geology, same soils, same tree treatment, three kind of different responses. When we sit back and instead of looking at it on a stream-by-stream basis, and I apologize for how hard this is to look like, but instead of looking at individual data points, if we look at the slope of that line for an individual year, there's post-harvest and pre-harvest lines to look at. If you focus in and look at those two dark black lines, there is a dark black line which is solid, and that's the mean post-harvest line. There is a dark dashed line which is the mean pre-harvest. If you look at those two, there's really no difference in those two lines, and that's the maximum daily temperature pre- and post-harvest regressions for all four of those units. If we look at minimum, you can see the same thing. You can see a dark dashed line, which is the mean pre-harvest, a dark solid line, which is the mean post-harvest. And what we actually see there is the minimum temperature on the hotter days has gone down. If we go down 1,000 feet, So those data were from the base of the harvest unit. If we go down 1,000 feet, we basically see nothing. So Myers is the control watershed. We're seeing basically no change there. And if we look at all the different data points, all the different streams, we simply have moved 1,000 feet downstream from the fruit flumes or 1,000 feet downstream from the harvest units. We don't see the pattern we saw at the base of the harvest units reflected there. So we see whatever effect we were seeing at the harvest units, we see that as having been removed. We go to the mouth of the watershed, South Fork and the North Fork. We basically see kind of the same pattern. We see the North Fork, which is the control, and we see the South Fork looking very much like the North Fork. There's really nothing we can say occurred there. So an interesting story there with temp, and a little bit different story there than we kind of expected to see. We really saw a range of responses at the base of the clear-cut boundary. The range of responses was such that we really end up seeing nothing occurring at that point. Whatever we saw occurring at the clear-cut boundary kind of went away by 1,000 feet, and so we're in the position of having to try to describe that, and then by the time we get to the mouth of the watersheds, we see no demonstrative response there. There's really nothing to see in this slide. What I wanted to say is as we look at the base of the clear-cuts, and we talk about what we think is occurring with stream flow, pretty much what we expected. We expected that where we removed the most trees, we would see some response in addition to mean daily flow. We're seeing that. We're seeing those flow responses during large storms, which is when we expect to see those. So pretty much what we're seeing happen with stream flow is what we expected to see happen. We have a similar set of analysis going on with mean daily sediment yield, and we're seeing increases in mean daily sediment yield where we're seeing increases in mean daily flow, about what we expected. This is kind of what we expected to have occur. We're not seeing the response outside of the large storms, so we're not seeing an increase in total daily flow during base flow periods. Pretty much on a preliminary level, that makes you feel pretty good. That says the forest practice rules have been working. We're not changing the sediment rating curves. We're not changing the sediment regime. We're changing a little bit the total amount of stream power by changing total stream flow, and we're seeing that come out during the large storms, and that's a pretty consistent story there. Fish. We've spent a lot of money on fish in there, and the response to the fish is going to be a while being put together. This, however, is just some basic data on fish that are caught. So every year in August, they go out and do a 100% census of all the fish in both watersheds, and you can see the total number of fish they've caught. So the first 4 years are calibration years going into the harvest. The year shaded there is the year it was being harvested, and then 2006 is the post-harvest year. Nothing really to say here except the fish are there. We're continuing to find the fish and look for patterns. Here, instead of just total numbers of fish, this is the growth rate of the fish. The top says pit-tagged fish. That's just fish that they've tagged and can go back and find again. Again, if you look at pre to post harvest, the growth rates really haven't changed. So that's just to say the fish are there, the fish are still there, and they're still kind of growing. If you want to kind of keep your eyes on the one piece of research coming out of Hinkle that's going to come out in the next month or two is looking at survival. And what we're looking at, when we look at fish, these are tagged fish. So when we go out and try to find the fish again and look at how well it is, how well we can go back and find those tagged fish, we're looking at a fairly awesome decay rate early on. And there's this time period of summer low flows between like August, September, and end of when it starts to rain again, where we see the most predation on these fish. So that's where the scientists are kind of zooming in and saying, okay, what's causing that loss of fish in those time periods? This is kind of looking, as a cutthroat study, this is looking a little bit different from some of the anadromous studies, where you measure kind of how well your fish are doing by smolt output coming out, and they kind of key in on winter habitat. And it's kind of looking like the winter habitat is not near as serious. The predation periods are in summer low flow. So we need to go back. Anyway, there's a guy named Aaron Berger that's going to be defending his thesis here in a month or two. And this is going to be his kind of real hard look on kind of what's happening in that summer low flow period. And basically, that's what I've got for you. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions? Committee members?
So,
I guess I'll ask a couple.
Preliminarily, then, what we're showing is that most of the research that was done and led to our current forest practices was done in a totally different environment. Here's our new studies that are coming out that we're just getting a chance of. So this is a couple years of data from Hinkle. We don't have the other data from the other two sets yet, which has a similar look. It doesn't. You don't get the big temperature growth. It doesn't appear, but you do see, you know, the growth change that was there in the original ones. It's just not as dynamic, I guess. It doesn't go up and down as much. And we're hoping that what we'll start to find is that temperature change is going to be continual to stay more steady because of the fact of the things that we're doing now as part of our regular Forest Practices Act.
Okay. Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, I might put a little bit different spin on it. I think the thing we saw coming out of the small headwater water, or the thing I saw coming out of the headwater watersheds that was most surprising is how mixed the response was.
Okay.
And with apologies to my regulator colleague here, I know they like simple rules and kind of a one-size-fits-all rule, and this is how headwater watersheds ought to be managed. And what we're kind of seeing is we're not seeing that. We're not seeing the real world overlay with that very easily. So we kind of expected a much different response than we're kind of getting up there. I would really expect as we move down into the fish-bearing streams where we do have buffer strips. And that's the thing I didn't emphasize, and I meant to, is realize that on those non-fish bearing streams there were no buffer strips left there. There was no formal buffer strips left. As we move down into the main fish bearing streams where we have those, we really would expect it to be much more moderate.
Okay.
And we would expect the data to show that you don't see the extreme changes. I don't think the atmosphere we're in, I don't think you, and we're arguing with objectives, adjectives here, and you said a totally different environment. It's not totally different. It's kind of the same environment. We've just spent 35 years working real hard to put rules on it, which allows extremes and environmental effect to be muted, and I think we'll see that.
If I may, I think the LC diagrams where it showed a very large temperature response in a burned and unit that was harvested clear for the banks, and obviously there was change in channel form as well, probably shallowed. But you know, we're clearly not seeing those kind of responses at all. Very muted at this point in time. The data around warmed water out of a clear cut entering a buffer, on, as it was the case here, cooling off. That's something that's been around as well. What was really missing and still is missing to some degree, and find throughout the analysis process, is given whatever changes are found, how are those transmitted to fish, either positive or negatively? There's been an assumption that it's been a cumulative effect and it's been a negative accumulative effect, even though a fair amount of studies show that as you actually open up some of these headwater streams, you increase primary productivity and actual volume or number of fish may increase because of the increase in food. There's been a presumed downstream effect that's adverse, and you know, we're going to be able to look at that through that this process, and that's what's very different about this. And again, we're also looking at amphibians, invertebrates, and other vectors in terms of the aquatic environment to try and explain, if we do see a change, what might be the causes. I guess some of the things that are also interesting, the predation factors come up in the Owl Sea watershed study as well in terms of pit tags, and I don't think we were expecting to see predation being as big of a factor, but we're finding the pit tags, which are little transducers in, stuck in the abdomen of fish, ending up on the bank and scat, and so apparently that's a fairly high source of mortality that we kind of thought would exist, but not to the magnitude that it does exist. This is one other point. The fish study does allow us to track both the growth, number, and location of the fish. And so these pit tags are able to track where the fish move to over time and space. So, again, if they respond to a treatment effect by going somewhere else, we'll be able to know that. And that's been also a missing part in terms of the Owl Sea study. Actually, they found some anomalies they couldn't explain because they couldn't know where the fish went, whether actually the increase in some fish was a result of something else or whether it was a result of the treatment. So this will allow us to look at the spatial distribution of the fish as well, and the traps will be somewhat similar to that.
Representative Brooklis.
Yeah, Mr. Follow-up to your question there, because you raised the issue kind of where we're going. I mean, we've been working on a set of rules, Forest Practices Act, for quite some time, and we're now saying that sometime in the future, based on what we're studying here, is that there needs to be either more latitude, some direction, plus or minus of what we're doing. Some of the assumptions that we've all made, well, I mean, there's many of us in this room here where we used to chunk creeks. You know, we had to crawl down in the mud in the middle of the driving rainstorm, you know, and chunk the creek out. And now, of course, we don't do that. We're doing 180 degrees from with that. Where do you think we're going? I mean, with studies like this, I mean, what's the economic impact? Are we looking at trying to take studies like this and go into the Forest Practice Act and be more sensitive to different environs? Or what's the next step? What's it cost? And because we're all arguing about we shouldn't be doing this, that, so on and so forth. We heard it in this whole committee hearing throughout the year that can't do this, can't do that because of. And now we're hearing science saying that, you know, this is a little bit more diverse out there than we thought.
I guess, Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, members of the committee, I think the data would argue that it's much more variable than we realize, and understanding that variability will help us become better at developing practices that are economically efficient while also better achieving their objective. And we're going to have to understand the physical processes that have created that variability, and hopefully this will help do that. We're beginning to better understand that, you know, notwithstanding the variability, you know, it is really important to think about having a mix of tools anyways, and really considering the dynamic process of the dry forest to sustain the forest. So this kind of falls in line with that kind of evolution of forestry, in the sense of we have had very prescriptive forestry in the Forest Practices Act, and what I think the terminology that I'd use now is options forestry. How do we create a range of options that will be both more efficient while also meeting better the landowner's interests? And that makes for more complex rules. As a regulator, I love, you know, leave a 100-foot buffer, and that makes it very simple to administer, but it's probably not necessarily the best thing for either the fish or the landowner.
Follow-up question, Tim.
Yep. Representative Wilson.
As you wish. I appreciate the data on which the analysis that are these particular tracks are is based, but I was wondering to what extent we can ask some more generalized sort of policy questions. And the question that occurs to me is that we have private timberlands that are much more intensively managed and harvested than our public lands. And I'm assuming that along our watersheds and the Coast Range in particular, that the mix of public to private is quite different depending on watershed. Have you determined that there are stronger fish runs in those watersheds that are have more, relatively more public lands along them, that is, they're less intensively managed and harvested, than in those that have more private lands? Is there a difference in depending on which is along?
Let me back up a step and talk about just the underlying science for a minute.
Okay.
Because this is a dialogue that we have had trying to get funding from the start of this. And because Hinkle Creek was the proof of concept watershed, and it was on Roseburg Forest Products, everybody assumed that what the study was about industrial land management. And we kept coming back with no. You have to look at what we're trying to do on watershed scale research. And what we're trying to do is look at, okay, you have a watershed, you're going to perturbate part of it, and you have some hypotheses about how when you perturbate the top of it, it affects the bottom. And what we really need is we need to come to grips with, are we right or wrong, or what do we need to know about watershed scale management? And I can use stream temperature as a very good example of this. Because if you go back, you don't have to go back that far. But, you know, I can quote some real nice literature from Bob Bestia, who I kind of learned at his feet for a while about. And the assumption was, if you go into a watershed anywhere and you open up the stream, that is going to have impacts on the stream temperature at the mouth. I mean, it does. And we fast forward just a little bit and we get into some of the active riparian zone management, and we get into some of the stuff that took place in the early 80s, and they started looking at that, and we started looking, okay, here's a clear cut, 1,000 feet downstream, what's happening to stream temperature? And it was kind of a mixed bag, but it wasn't necessarily always hotter. So people started looking at mechanisms and paradigms and saying, okay, how can we explain how this water that was heated at the base of the clear cut gets cooler 1,000 feet downstream? So we started coming up with groundwater flux and some real honest mechanisms which we could go out and measure. We said, okay, if you heated it up here 1,000 feet down, it could be cooler because these things were going on. And we've got a lot of those going. If you look at Hinkle Creek, and again, I think this is as good an example of how come it's as important to be lucky as it is good. We've got one watershed, which for whatever reason, and we really haven't been able to understand why it occurred, it actually cooled. We actually had maximum daily temps a degree and a half cooler at that watershed than they were 1,000. But when we go 1,000 feet down, for that watershed, that water didn't get even cooler. It came back up. So now we're at the watershed scale saying, okay, it doesn't necessarily always warm up. It doesn't necessarily always cool down. Maybe there's this, it comes back to whatever we think background is. How do we define background? And how do we go out and find that on streams before we log so we kind of know what's going on? So I think at one level, even with federal land, because I don't think I think we went to a headwaters research workshop at the University of British Columbia in mid-January. And I sat there and I listened to 2.5 days of presentations on headwaters research. And the only set of research which had the watershed scale as an objective within the research was Hinkle Creek and the Watersheds Research Co-op. Everybody else was sitting at the top looking at the impacts of headwaters management, and they didn't have a chunk of their research which was to look at what's going on downstream. And when we've talked to the Bureau of Land Management, and when we've talked to the Forest Service, and we've talked to other folks, what we've tried to emphasize is this isn't a Roseburg study. This is a study about watershed scale effects. And so I think that fits. I think trying to worry about things at that scale fits. And that's kind of where we are. Now, truly, because the landowners that have invited us on to do research are private landowners for the most part, we're certainly going to have the private industrial land a little bit better nailed than federal land. But there is a level at which we go beyond ownership on this.
If I may, Chair Roblin, yeah. Representative McPherson, the part of the dilemma we have in forest practices, federal or private, is we've kind of got two extremes where you've got what we call highly economically efficient forest practices with private lands and something very, very conservative on the federal lands. Over time, we can use these studies, particularly the TRASS, to look at the intermediate points. You know, what are the trade-offs? And this has huge relevance for that purpose. And then, probably equally important with regard to the federal planning effort, there's been an assumption they've made that there is a set of cumulative effects that come off of private lands that therefore then constrain public land management, and this will address some of those issues as well. Specifically with regard to fish populations, I'm going to answer one. I don't know, but from anecdotal information, I say the state doesn't know either. It's too variable to think about it that way. For example, coho historically probably were on the lower ends of the stream networks, lower gradient lands. The federal lands tend to be higher up in the system, so you can't really judge federal land productivity. But generally when it comes to coho, coho populations don't do all that well on federal lands, but you wouldn't expect them to. But cutthroat are really kind of the canary in the mine. They're a resident fish that also is anadromous, potadromous as well. They live their life cycle in a relatively small area. They're very broadly distributed, and they're equally well distributed on private and federal lands, and according to some of the work at OSU, and this was, again, better be luck than good. Part of our cooperation with USGS is they actually went out and did a study of cutthroat populations that are isolated above barriers. And so they have that data set where we could actually look at population responses and how they're doing based upon their isolation. And I do know one of the recent studies found that in a totally bizarre result that areas with greater road density have better distribution of cutthroat trout. So that doesn't make any sense in the world, but that's what one study shows. So I would say it's probably a really mix. You can have old forest with very poor habitat because dynamic processes are what cause habitat to change and improve over time and also decay over time. So an old forest that's, you know, 500 years post-disturbance, it's lost its woods, not very good habitat. For a young forest post-disturbance, in fact, typically for some of the fires we've seen in Oregon as well as the Yellowstone fires, post-fire, the actual length of fish increased because the productivity went up, and that's a fairly consistent pattern. So the disturbance can be good for fish. It can be not good for fish.
Representative Burley.
Actually, Representative Boquist had a question first.
Just to follow up to the, because you made mention here, management, public versus private. I mean, we have a TRASS study that's obviously in the middle of the Tillamook Forest. How do you think this study is going to impact your management of the Tillamook Forest and the million-dollar question we've asked five times this year?
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, members of the committee, I mean, very clearly it'll be used to inform those decisions. You know, I deal with the private land side of things. Very clearly, we need to understand the trade-offs better that might come from doing something different. We don't have as good a handle on some of those trade-offs, and these kind of studies will definitely allow us to start picking those data points. And very clearly, there's a lot of diminishing returns with temperature. The influence of buffers on water temperature begins to diminish the further away from the channel, and we can start addressing where those points of diminishing return are by having a whole bunch of data points, as well as right now just pretty bifurcated data points. The TRASS itself, they're still in discussion of what sort of treatments will go in place, but again, this information is going to help inform the kind of treatments we might look at.
Representative Berlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple questions. One following up on Representative McPherson. If I could kind of rephrase this question, perhaps. Has post-LC, has there been any type of extensive paired watershed studies like this done on federal lands?
Chair Roblin, Representative Burley, members of the committee. To my knowledge, no. When we look at the group, we're actually trying to get a concerted little group of folks doing contemporary paired watershed studies. And when you look at the group of folks that are doing the contemporary paired watershed studies right now, the common themes that run through it are they're on private industrial managed land, they're looking at harvest regenerated stands with roads, and it's interesting to go to these conferences and listen to these folks talk, because when they get up and they give their problem statement and preamble, it's like they read my speech for the most part. So they've got the same issues and the same things. And so what's driving the research are opportunities and concerns about intensive private land management, because one of the hypotheses going in is current intensive management of private land is just too intense. And it's got to be bad. And so what we're just simply trying to do is inform that.
Yeah, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I don't think there's enough gold in Fort Knox to pay for the NEPA that it would be required to do something like this on public land. Second question, funding. To embark on projects like this, obviously this is not just a shot in the arm, you know, let's fund this thing for 1 year. This is a commitment that we're making over the course of 5+ years, I'm presuming. So please discuss how exactly is this being funded. I know in the Department of Forestry's budget there's an item in there for Watershed Research Cooperative, and I'm not sure exactly. I think it's $1.5 million. Is that the sole source of funding for this? What would happen if you don't get that?
Chairman Roblin, Representative Burley, members of the committee. The funding right now, and up until very, very recently, it's just been Hinkle Creek. So most of my knowledge and experience is keeping Hinkle Creek funded. It has followed, if you follow traditional OSU cooperatives, it has followed kind of the OSU cooperative framework, and that there has been an effort to go to the local level and get some level of funding from the local level, and then do our best to leverage that at the federal level. And that has worked well. It is a cooperative. We have a handful of cooperators, and we have been able to bring in somewhere in the vicinity of $250,000 a year for the cooperative. And then for the last 2 years, we've been able to leverage that with the federal earmark. And at least at Hinkle Creek, we've been looking at about $700,000 to $750,000 a year to keep that going. Something the size of Hinkle Creek and Trask basically takes just shy of $1 million a year to keep going. I mean, you're looking at running 8 gauging stations, doing a total fish census on the entire watershed every year, so forth and so on. So we were never really funded fully, even under the $750,000. We were still looking at outside funds to try and get some other stuff coming in. And so for something Hinkle Creek-esque size, we're looking at about $900,000 a year. The ALC is a little bit, the ALC is about a third of that, because it's about a third of the project that the other two are. So that's basically what we're looking at over a long term. We've had good success up until this last year with Hinkle Creek. Over the last year, it's been challenged. And we're on carryover funds right now, and we haven't, I guess we just don't have funds coming in right now for Hinkle.
If I may, the chair of members committee, the infrastructure, like I said, for Hinkle Creek was funded by OWEB grant. We've got a similar grant request in for the Trask. There's some temporal issues there, because in terms of budget cycle,
That's a little bit off of when we had hoped to get the infrastructure installed and that, but that's a considerable sum of money. And the infrastructure lends itself well to their capital grant process. So we don't know whether we'll get that grant or not, but that's been our pattern, is to use OWEB dollars for the infrastructure, which is fascinating stuff to see built and installed. Douglas County was contributing a fair amount, $100,000+.
$150,000
a year. From their rural community, Secure Rural Schools Act dollars, and we had a federal earmark for about $500,000 as well. Both those are obviously shaky now, given the federal budget situation.
Thank you, gentlemen. I just want to follow up on that, and it's been a little while since I read the Hinkle Creek study, because I appreciated you sending that to me when that came out. A couple of questions. One is, I was curious if you're eligible for using the research dollars under Measure 66 for, you said capital grant, so I mean, this seems like we'd be a better fit under the research dollars, which is the money, you know, that the interest earns from Measure 66. I'm curious if you're going to be looking at that.
Chair Roblin, Representative Nathan Fielder, members of the committee. We've discussed that with OWEB. Generally, they're not real excited about operating grants for long-term research like this, and these are 10-year projects, so that's part of the issue there. We are going to take a stab at that, obviously, as we are finding ourselves in those kind of situations, but this has been quite a cooperative, and certainly we've gotten funds from everything from the Umpqua Fisheries Enhancement Derby to Friends of the Paul Bunyan to little kid on the street selling Kool-Aid. So we've made our best on it. We are continuing to pursue federal budget opportunities as well through the Farm Bill.
And a follow-up?
Yep.
So in these areas, since you're using OWEB funds, I'm assuming that you're also looking at the impacts of OWEB-funded projects in those watersheds. And you may have talked about that, but I might have missed that part of the presentation. So,
Sure.
we're constantly struggling for, you know, how we can show success impacts with the Oregon plan, and we had a pretty robust discussion in the Ways and Means subcommittee on that. So, just curious, since monitoring is a big component of Measure 66 as well.
Okay. Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfeld, members of the committee. You know, the Forest Practices Act is a key element of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and the context of evaluating its efficiency is actually a major part of the Oregon plan, and we've represented this process as part of overall monitoring work, but this does get into more of the research element. In terms of specific to the Oregon plan measures, there are a number of measures related to roads and road reconstruction upgrading, and this is an example of where, as they're going through the harvesting process, they are upgrading their roads and doing what they would do under the Oregon Plan and Forest Practices Act. So it is a metric of that efficiency. Overall, this basin was in relatively good shape when it came to the roads to begin with. I know they've installed some new culverts that are fairly substantive, and new road surfacing, but in terms of specific restoration projects, there aren't any like large wood placement. Now, one thing that makes this study and the Trask study a little bit more powerful as well, they are tied into OEF&W broader scale life cycle projects, looking at anadromous just going in and out. Now, Hinkle's above most anadromy, but Trask is going to get pretty well tied to that, with the Trask having a good life cycle study.
The ALC study, because if you follow the history of the ALC watershed study, one of the things they did with Needle Branch Watershed was clean the large wood out of it. And when you go back and look at what they think is limiting in the ALC, they think that large wood and structure is one of the things that's limiting. So one of the things they're going to do as part of their study is, in addition to the forest practices that they're going to be engaged in with the harvest, they're going to try to put structure back into that system. And as part of a paired watershed study, see what impact putting that large wood has on that. To my knowledge, it's not going to be an OWEB project. It's just going to be something that Plum Creek's going to do. Mm-hmm. But there will be some data collected on that. The other two studies, to my knowledge, don't have de facto restoration type projects involved in them.
Quick question then. First one, are we doing other than just temperature on these? Are we looking at whatever it could be, the nitrates in the water?
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, we have six projects, at least with Hinkle. Definitely, we're looking at the effects on hydrology, water quality. Water quality is temperature and sediment. We also have a funded project on stream chemistry, which is the nutrients. Believe it or not, it is basically a biology project. The biggest amount of the budget goes to the fish. Behind that, we have amphibians. And behind that, we have invertebrates, which are basically insects but include other than just insects. And then we also have a fully funded project through the Forest Science Department, which is basically somebody to look at statistically how do you analyze all that data. We've tried to put together what is called an integrated project, and there's a lot of questions about what does that mean. But what we try to do is integrate the analysis and the physical and the biological data. And while that may seem to be something which is fairly trivial, we've spent many an hour just explaining nouns and verbs to each other. And so we actually have, it's in the vicinity of $120,000 to $150,000 project through the College of Forestry at Oregon State University to do nothing but put the cutting-edge statistical analysis tools together to allow us to do it. So it is a lot more than just stream temperature.
If I may, Chair Roblin, the members of the committee, one of the other important points about the cooperative is just having a single paired watershed gives you a single set of data points, and it's hard to make any inferences beyond that location. And to the extent we're learning new things, having somewhat similar data points in these other paired watershed studies adds tremendous amount of power to whatever we find. Now, it may find variability, which is fine. It may find some consistency, which is fine. We are also, like Arnie said, trying to get a broader scale regional cooperative going. There is a work in Idaho on, I believe it's Potlatch Lands. And Washington is doing some work as well. And again, to the extent we can do this kind of work on different geologies and start finding some consistencies or inconsistencies, that's going to really help in terms of how we, again, start pursuing forest management and practices. So this is pretty powerful work. The LC study was really one data point that drove a lot of decision-making, but other studies since then have found tremendously different results in terms of impacts, and people often explain those away as, well, gee whiz, we shouldn't put too much weight in that because we really ought to be more concerned about cumulative effects without ever defining that. So this is really cutting-edge stuff. And again, from our view of the world, is we've got to find a way to allow the intensively managed forest, the reserve forest, the more multi-purpose forests to integrate together in a way that allow the landowners to meet their needs while overall providing sustainable forestry. And this is really cutting edge to do that integration.
Okay, go ahead. Just a comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. I'm not sure whether or not you've visited any of these research locations, but I would, since I've got the chairs here of two relevant committees, I would encourage during the interim that folks get out and see this stuff. I had the opportunity to go to Hinkle Creek, and one of the things that fascinated me was they actually tried to put solar cells in the tops of Douglas fir to drive these remote monitoring locations, which didn't work, so now you're packing in marine batteries, and I tried to hook them up with Idatech and get fuel cells out there. But it really is fascinating, and to go out with the scientists and see these flumes and what they're measuring and these pit tags and the fish, it's just it's great effort, and I really do support it. I went out to Mica Creek on Potlatch Lands. They put that in, I think, about 15 years ago. Dale first got that started, and this is the kind of information we really need to help us make these policy decisions. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I fully support, and I encourage both chairs to get committee members out and go see this.
Yeah, we can do it, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other question I had, you talked about depredation, and you were a little surprised at that. Are we talking about the fry? Are we talking about a little older fish? And do we have an idea of what it is that's doing the depredation?
Yeah. Chair Roble, members of the committee, there's all kinds of hypotheses about how come fish die.
Right.
And what they have done is I don't know if you can remember what the map of Hinkle Creek looks like, but we've got these main stems, and then we've have these fish-bearing tribs. And they've gone about, and the data I showed you is for all the fish and all the watershed. So averages are whatever they are. But what you talk to the people who go out there and worry about this, and what they found is they would have a trib, a small trib, and they'd go look for the fish, and the fish would be there for two or three or four times, and then they'd go out again, and it just wing off. And they're kind of saying, okay, what's driving this highly variable behavior in these little tribs? And then of course, as you spend more and more time going out there and looking, they're able to kind of say, okay, here's this little pile of mink scat with two pit tags on it, and so they've obviously had weird things going on where a pit tag would come racing down the stream, and it would go through this gate, which is a place we can measure where the tag is. It'll miss this one, but it'll hit this one, and they're going, okay, what can move that fast but miss a gate? And so, I mean, there's just been a lot of questions, but they've kind of came back to, on these very, very small streams, one of the things they're going to, with survival, one of the things they're going to have to worry about and they're going to have to come to grips with is predation, because it's obviously there and they don't really understand. Again, we've got this variability thing going on, and how come it can just hit one stream and not hit another one? And really, before you get to the point where you explain the effects of harvest on these headwater streams, you have to explain the other things that are going on to kill fish. And so that's one of the things they're kind of trying to hone in on right now.
Chair, it might be worth mentioning the pit tag process. They're trying to tag every fish by inserting this inducer into its abdomen of a certain size and larger. And so what they're going to have data on are relatively robust fish for those kind of streams. They're not large fish, but they're probably older fish in that context. So again, what we're going to learn is about those sampled fish that have pit tags in them. We may not learn a whole lot about smaller fish, but the anomalies are going to be interesting to explain. I know on the ALSI, one of the characteristics of the one channel is that it dries up in the summer, even though it's fish bearing during fair amount of the year. And again, how do you explain, how do you deal with that? And that's, you know, pretty important, I think, in the sense of that's pretty common. Like one of the assumptions we made in our water protection rules that fish tend to move up to a point that will oftentimes be dry in the summer, so protecting it for temperature becomes relatively less important. Well, we're going to learn more about that.
Any further questions?
I guess something I'd say is that I'm one of those people who really does believe we need to have some science behind many of the assumptions that we make here and in policy. And, you know, just the one that was near us when they started doing the DNA testing of the bacteria in the streams, and they found out that a whole lot of it had come from birds, which they'd never thought as being the contributor to the E. coli and these places. And so all of a sudden you start looking around thinking differently than we did before, when we had made the assumption that it was always farming practices that, and then the rain that created it, and all of a sudden maybe it's not, maybe it's some other things. And I guess until we do this, everybody can have their own guess as to what it is, and hopefully the better we get at it, the more it will help inform what we do here in policy. So, and I think we should take them up on the idea of going out and visiting. So thank you very much.
Yes. If I could make a comment,
absolutely,
too, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I want to echo the comment that you made. We need the best science that we can get. And that I'd also encourage you that, well, I know it's important to study things like stream temperature, and that is a, I understand, being a non-scientist, but I understand it has a significant effect on fish populations, that in the end, if our goal is to try to have strong fish populations, it's the measurable impact on fish populations that we should be looking at. I mean, the intermediate analysis of what the drivers are, that's a good and appropriate inquiry to undertake, but it's not the bottom line answer. That is, to me, having lower stream temperatures in our coast range streams probably in itself isn't necessarily good, bad, or indifferent. It's as it affects something that's tangible, like our fish runs, that it becomes important.
Chair Roland, Representative McPherson, members of the committee, totally agree with you, and certainly the paired watershed studies are probably the one approach where you can actually do that, correct the physical processes, temperature, sediment, channel structure, whatever, with the biological processes. Now, the limit on the Hinkle Creek is that we are looking at resident fish, and it gets much more complicated as you look at the effects on anadromous fish. And well, we would view cutthroat trout as a pretty good indicator for fish response, and not always the total indicator for coho, but they're probably a pretty good indicator for fish response. And certainly one of the big areas of debate we've had with regard to forest practices is the temperature issue is kind of an issue, because you've got a mix of temperature and light, and light drives productivity, temperature drives metabolism, and up to a point, as long as the food have enough fish, the metabolism is increased and they grow really fast. But if the temperature gets too high, or you don't have enough food, or some combination thereof, then you start having problems, and at some point you just hit a lethal threshold. But understanding that on a watershed scale is very complex, and this allows us to start looking at those sorts of things.
If I may respond to your response, I mean, thanks for saying that. When we put all of these projects together, but when we put them together and we sat down and said, okay, what do we need to study? And there's always the interest in the effective forest management and physical parameters, and then they're linked through a lab study to fish. And so we said throughout, these are going to be fish studies. The response variable is going to be fish. We're going to do what we've got to do that and do it right. And that's why, despite the fact it's one out of six projects, it's a third to half the budget. So the fish part of the budget is a huge piece, and that's because bottom line is that's the response variable. That's what we've got to know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
It did, actually.
I need to get one of those.